You are with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The economic and social heart of Milwaukee's Black community was demolished by freeway construction in the 1960s. But years of redevelopment efforts are making some community members hopeful that Bronzeville could become a hub for Black culture again. Corrine Hess has more.
Located just 2 miles north of downtown Milwaukee, Bronzeville thrived for decades with vibrant small businesses and a nightlife that drew people across racial lines. Freeway construction in the 1960s meant the loss of more than 8,000 homes and churches, and the once tight-knit community scattered across Milwaukee. Artist Metope Johnson lived in Bronzeville until he was about 8 years old. Johnson is now in his late 60s, but he still remembers how vibrant of a community it once was.
But we could go to, you know, the grocery store, or we can go to the doctor. If the doctor didn't come to us, because the doctor actually came to visit you at your home.
Last spring, Johnson opened an art exhibit in Milwaukee detailing what old Bronzeville was like. And with new ethnic restaurants in the neighborhood and stores like the Bronzeville Collective, where 25 local vendors have opened shop, Johnson thinks some of the old vibrancy might be coming back.
What I've seen in the most recent years have really begun to pave the way for a huge improvement.
At the heart of the neighborhood is G's Clippers. Owner Gollin Smith was one of the first pioneers of the new Bronzeville when he moved to shop there in 2006. Walking into G's feels like stepping into another time period. Signs on the door caution guests to protect themselves against COVID-19, but inside, maskless people rap songs from another era. James Flippin has been a barber here for 5 years. He calls G's the neighborhood hangout.
This right here gives you a chance to come back into the inner city a little bit more, see a little bit more of what we have to offer.
In addition to the small Black-owned businesses like G's, there are larger projects in the works. The Greater Milwaukee Foundation and the Medical College of Wisconsin are turning a former Gimbel's department store into offices and programming space. This week, America's Black Holocaust Museum will open after being closed for more than a decade. It was one of the only museums dedicated to telling the history of lynching in the United States when it closed in 2008. The museum was founded by lynching survivor James Cameron, who died at age 92 in 2006. One block over, a closed state office building is slated to be the new Bronzeville Center for the Arts, another anchor for the neighborhood. Artist Della Wells serves on the Arts Center board. She lived in Bronzeville as a child. She says over the years, some independent Black artists and writers remained in Bronzeville, but this project will showcase Black culture and give the artistic community another place to gather.
No one in Wisconsin is really, you know, talking about African-American art and art of the Afro-diaspora. By that, I mean the history of it, so we're going to take that mission on.
The momentum is drawing national attention to Bronzeville. Last month, the New York Times featured Bronzeville on its list of 52 places for a changed world. One of the people working behind the scenes is Deshea Gee, who recently led the neighborhood's business improvement district. Gee says people's mindset about the neighborhood's place in the city is changing.
It's just a place that has so much meaning, has so much history. It really inspires me to just keep going and know that there's more to do.
There are still empty lots and storefronts in Bronzeville, but people like Gee see it attracting diverse businesses and residents in one of the most segregated cities in the country, and again ready to make history. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And now to people with weakened immune systems and what it feels like to be high risk in these times. As COVID enters its third year, transplant recipients, cancer patients, and millions of other Americans with compromised immune systems may feel left behind as governments lift mask mandates and shift back to normal. Are you immunocompromised? How are you doing? Have you received a fourth COVID vaccine booster? Did that make you feel more confident about being in public spaces? Join in 800-642-1234. Dr. Janina Smith is a faculty member in the Division of Infectious Disease at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. She is medical director of the Transplant Infectious Disease Program at UW Hospitals and Clinics. Dr. Smith, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Oh, how concerned are you for your patients at this point in the pandemic?
Unfortunately, I'm very concerned for the risk to my patients. The Omicron wave, though it may have been listed as mild for many people, was not mild for patients with compromised immune systems.
Can you talk about the two main groups of people who are living with compromised immune systems? I mean, some people are born with immune deficiencies. Other people acquire their immunodeficiency, like through, you know, living life, like, you know, cancer, MS, an organ transplant. Connect the dots for us. Explain how these millions of people can still be vulnerable after having extra COVID vaccine doses.
Absolutely. So you pointed out quite correctly that there are patients who are born with immune defects and those who have acquired immune defects a lot of times through therapies. So what happens is if, for example, I'm going to use organ transplant as an example because it's a large population.
Close to your heart.
Yes, very close to my heart. The medicines that we use to prevent rejection of the new transplanted organ, the purpose of those is not to be able to develop an immune response. So they reduce the ability to make antibodies against the new organ and to make T cells, which are the cells that are kind of educated as part of our cell-mediated immune response. They're specifically made so that those are not as active to not cause rejection. An unfortunate consequence is that they're not specific for the organ, and they make it so that the immune response isn't strong to anything new that's encountered. So the COVID vaccine, the intention of it is to make a good antibody and T cell response. And what we unfortunately worried and has been confirmed, they don't make good antibodies on average. In fact, after a regular vaccine course, less than 50% of transplant recipients made antibodies that were detectable really at all. And so that's why we recommended the third dose, which was very effective at bumping that up above 60%. But unfortunately, with the Omicron wave, just as it affected others who'd been vaccinated or had some natural immunity because of infection, that did not hold true for our immunocompromised patients. The same is true for patients, for example, with rheumatoid arthritis or other autoimmune conditions. The medicines that are used to treat those are intended to blunt the immune response. And unfortunately, that means that patients are not able to develop immunity to COVID, and are when they get exposed, it's as if they've never their immune system's never seen it before.
So just layering on extra doses of the COVID vaccine may not always be very useful or entirely productive in protecting someone with a weakened immune system.
That's exactly right. We certainly recommend it because some immune response is better than no immune response.
Mm-hmm.
And we did see increase in the immune response after each doses in immunocompromised patients. The dose regimen is 4. However, because of this problem, there are other things that we've tried to do. And I think one of the most important is if a patient can't make antibodies themselves, we can actually give them antibodies that stay in the system and last about 6 months. And there is a drug that was developed to do just that. One of the unfortunate things is with Omicron, just as it's not as susceptible to immunization-based immunity or even actually infection-based immunity, this infusion of antibodies is not quite as effective in Omicron, but it is something that we can do to protect people who can't make antibodies themselves.
If I'm understanding this, is this called passive immunization, giving monoclonal antibodies to at-risk people to protect them before they get the virus?
That is exactly what it's called. So active immunization is when we ask the immune system to make its own antibodies. Passive is when we realize it may not have time or may not be capable, and we infuse antibodies. That's exactly what it's called.
So at this point, what do you tell immunocompromised patients about how they go about living their life, you know, going out in public or just trying to, you know, go to work or go to the grocery store, to their medical appointments?
Yeah, this is a really important question. I get messages from my patients very frequently that the question of removing mask mandates is quite terrifying to them. And I certainly understand that. While the jury's still out, certainly many places there are no mask mandates. My first recommendation or plea to the public would be to consider maintaining mask mandates in what I call safe spaces. So that's the grocery store, the pharmacy, the healthcare clinic, places of worship, places that people really can't avoid, attending, and that it's an important part to just live life. Hmm. If that doesn't happen for patients individually, I definitely recommend they get all of their vaccine doses. Some percentage of patients will react. And as I say, after the third dose, we saw up to 60% having good antibody levels. I recommend that they place themselves as candidates for antibody infusions with the passive immunity that we've talked about. And then the next really important step, so when I think about immunity, having antibodies really, the intention is to prevent severe illness, not necessarily getting infected at all. But masks, especially good quality masks, are to prevent infection. And that's true for everybody, whether you're immune compromised or not. I have multiple members of my family and certainly have seen patients who are not immune compromised, but who still felt very sick when they got COVID. So masks still protect individuals. So if you're forced to enter a space where there is a lot of unmasked individuals, the quality of mask matters. Hmm. So when we're talking about good, better, best, any kind of face shield is better than nothing. Surgical masks are better than cloth face shields, but going up, higher quality masks like the medical respirator that I wear is an N95 that's fitted. That's not in reach for most patients, but N95s that are not fitted, including a very comfortable one that was just released by 3M, is a really good option. And then also KN95s, which are healthcare quality masks in other countries, are actually extremely comfortable. They're, for me, much more comfortable than wearing a surgical mask because they fit my face much better, and those provide more protection. And so for my transplant recipients, I do recommend they wear a higher-level mask in public.
Let's pause there with transplant infectious disease physician Janina Smith explaining what people with weakened immune systems have experienced in COVID. Should cities renew mask mandates? Take other measures to protect immunocompromised residents? Have you gotten COVID and received monoclonal antibodies? What should preventative COVID measures do, or when do they get rolled back? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the IDS Network. The head of the CDC suffered backlash last month, seeming to imply that the only people dying of COVID were people with pre-existing medical issues. We're discussing what it's like to navigate the pandemic with a weakened immune system on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Good Morning America interview with CDC Director Rochelle Walensky was edited down, and then later ABC released the full version after people called her out for being callous, and it prompted the hashtag #MyDisabledLifeIsWorthy. Here is the 30-second unedited excerpt of what Walensky said.
A study of 1.2 million people who were vaccinated between December and October and demonstrated that severe disease occurred in about 0.015% of the people who were received their primary series, and death in 0.003% of those people. The overwhelming number of deaths, over 75%, occurred in people who had at least four comorbidities. So really, these are people who were unwell to begin with.
Do public health leaders and lawmakers respect medical risks in COVID? Still time, 800-642-1234. Transplant infectious disease doctor Janina Smith stays with us. Dr. Smith, what were your thoughts when you heard the CDC director talking there about people who have pre-existing conditions?
I'm not going to lie. I found it devastating. Quote further goes on for her to say that she thought that was good news. And these are my patients, and they're very valuable, vital, important members of our society. And so I certainly didn't find their risk, their illness, and their deaths to be good news. I think perhaps, her perspective, looking at all of society and seeing that there was still good vaccine efficacy, you know, of course, was encouraging. But I remain steadfast in my advocacy for patients who are immunocompromised. I would also say that as a practicing physician, persons with four comorbidities doesn't necessarily mean that they're very sick. They may be your coworker, your child's friend's parent, your neighbor, and even regardless, every life, you know, matters. There's a very prominent global health advocate who just died this week, and I'd like to use a quote from him that to have global health equity, no life can be worth more than any other life.
Hmm. Let's take a call now. Alyssa's in Sparta. Hi, Alyssa's. Are you there?
Good morning, yes.
Good morning. What would you like to say?
Just along the lines of what you're discussing, I have received both of my vaccinations, my booster, and I am pregnant, which makes me immunocompromised. I obtained COVID in November 2020, and I just obtained COVID last month during the Omicron variant. To paint the picture a little bit, my entire household wears masks when we exit our residence, including my three-year-old. We haven't seen some of our best friends in many months. People kind of ask me where they think I got the variant, and then my answer was, you know, at work or at the gas station, because we even do grocery side pickup. And so I just feel, especially when I was sick and having to isolate from my family, a high level of frustration that what I would classify as kind of compassion fatigue from the general population, and just a lack of caring in a lot of cases.
Compassion fatigue, Dr. Smith.
Absolutely. I think that's a big part of the problem. But ultimately, you know, for me, for example, we talk about burnout as kind of a similar condition of compassion fatigue, really allowing yourself to know your patients and feel for their circumstances and their fears and their suffering really can restore compassion. But I do think that that's the problem overall in terms of leaving behind all of the patients that are immunocompromised and remain at risk, or women like you who are pregnant and therefore at much enhanced risk of sickness and, in fact, mortality from COVID.
Alyssa, thank you for the call. Herb now in Madison. Herb, you are a transplant, a liver transplant recipient.
That's correct.
What would you like to say?
Well, I've been very vigilant throughout the pandemic and following the recommendations of my transplant team. I'm totally vaccinated, including my second booster shot now. I've been very astute in wearing masks and now do a KN95 mask. I avoid crowded places of virtually any kind. But despite all that, I think I'm leading a fairly good life. I've had to sacrifice doing certain kinds of things, but I've replaced that with a sense of gratitude, a continual gratitude for being alive today. Even all these many years after my transplant, it's been a wonderful life for me.
30 years and counting.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Oh, Dr. Smith, what about this mindset of gratitude?
Oh, it makes me so happy to hear. It is the most rewarding and amazing thing in my entire medical practice to see individuals who are given this new chance at life. And I don't think Herb's attitude is unique amongst transplant recipients. They are resilient and grateful and just such a rewarding population to work with. And I think that's, when we're talking about compassion fatigue, that's the part to focus on. These are our amazing fellow Americans, and their lives are worth protecting.
Herb, thank you for joining in as we talk with Dr. Janina Smith, Medical Director of the Transplant Infectious Disease Program at UW Hospitals and Clinics. Kevin in Janesville has something to add. Kevin, hi. What's on your mind?
Hi, good morning. I think we're just lifting these mask mandates and recommendations far too early. Doctor, would it be a reasonable analogy to say, hey, cancer patient, your tumor has been shrunk by 50 or 60%, so we're going to stop all chemo and radiation, and we'll just see how it goes, and if things get bad, maybe we can start back up again. How many of us would be okay with that kind of medical advice?
Right. I mean, I agree with you, in particular in regards to safe spaces. I do understand that there are some people who feel that they are themselves at lower risk and want to do something more what I would view as, you know, risky, more likely to lead to exposure, like, you know, eating out in restaurants or going to bars. But when, like our first caller today, who was saying that she severely limited her activities, it's not really fair that she can't go to the gas station or the pharmacy without being put at higher risk. So I entirely do agree with you. The last piece of that is, I think people have the attitude now, well, we can't keep doing this forever. Mm-hmm. But the reality is there's been amazing scientific advances, absolutely amazing during the pandemic, including the development of the monoclonal antibodies that are long acting and protective, as we talked about, but also therapeutics mm-hmm. that have been developed are really quite effective, but not available. There's just not enough of them. And so I don't think it's a matter of holding out forever. I think it's a matter of holding out until some of these other agents that we know work, until that they are accessible to everyone.
Dr. Smith, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's such an important topic.
Dr. Janina Smith, faculty member in the Division of Infectious Disease at UW School of Medicine and Public Health, medical director of the Transplant Infectious Disease Program at UW Hospitals and Clinics. Just ahead, we start a series of conversations about the Great Lakes with the executive director of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa and a research ecologist with NOAA. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.